Welcome to Dark Corners with David Allan Boyles. Dark Corners is brought to you by Gestalt Media, an independent publishing company dedicated to serving independent authors. Just Retribution, Part 1, by David Allan Boyles. Western Carolina Insane Asylum, Morganton, North Carolina. Patient, William Haraway. Attending physician, Dr. Francis L. Barrington. Date admitted, September 12, 1889. Release, departure, October 1. 1889. Mr. Haraway escaped after attacking an attendant. His whereabouts thereafter remain unknown. The following documents, journal entries written by the patient per directive of the attending physician, are to be included in the patient's files along with all physician notes of physical and psychiatric examinations. September 17, 1889. Barrington tells me to write in the belief that through the means of expressing my irrational fears, my anxiety will diminish. The fool fails to grasp that I am far beyond any sort of therapy. Still, I must occupy myself somehow, so I write. I shall begin with my first visit to this institution 6 months ago, my visit to see Jeremiah Pritchard, the madman. My host greeted me excitedly and motioned for me to sit on the single iron-framed cot in the Stark cell. "Visitors are a rarity for me, I'm afraid," he said, "so your patience with my lapsed skills of conversation will be most appreciated. Oh, I used to receive all kinds of visitors, the sheriff and other investigators. But you are a very special guest." According to the records, the man who sat before me was only 35 years of age, but he had the appearance of a man of at least 60. What hair he still possessed was sparse and completely white. His bony frame hardly seemed capable of supporting his weight, although he could not have weighed more than 100 pounds. At times he was extremely alert and quite coherent, but these periods lasted briefly. More often, his attention drifted, and he would frown and gaze at some fixed point in the sparsely furnished gray room, perhaps reliving an incident of extreme mental and physical anguish, as his doctor, Francis Barrington, the director of this newly established asylum, had warned me during our initial interview. The dialogue in which we engaged was most extraordinary, according to Barrington, for prior to my visit, he rarely spoke more than a few words at a time. I had been allowed to visit Pritchard under the guise of being his brother. Since the only means of identifying the patient was a letter of confirmation for hotel accommodations found in his coat pocket, no one could deny that I spoke the truth. I convinced the imbecile in charge that I had been living abroad and had lost contact with my brother. Upon returning to the States on business, I'd learned that Jeremiah, a lover of wildlife and an outdoor enthusiast, had disappeared a few years ago while traveling with a group of like-minded individuals who sought to explore the terrain around Mount Mitchell. I claimed that through one of Jeremiah's friends, I had discovered that my brother, inspired by the recent publication of the journals of Elisha Mitchell, had traveled by train to Gray Eagle, North Carolina, and had joined a group of naturalists there for an expedition. When I received no word from my brother after my attempt to contact him, I became concerned and searched for someone who might provide me with answers. I learned, through eventual contact with one of the members of that group, that he had become separated from his fellow explorers on one of their explorations and had never been found. Soon after my own arrival at the small town of Gray Eagle, I told Dr. Barrington, I received information that filled me with an overpowering sense of both anticipation and dread. Unlike the rest of my creative narrative, this last statement was completely true. Through a conversation with the owner of the Mount Mitchell Hotel, a man named Mont Stepp, who was so inflated with a sense of his own importance and who so loved to hear himself talk that it was all I could do not to throttle him, I learned the very strange story of a man found raving in the basement of an abandoned house located in a remote section outside the Gray Eagle community. My claim to Dr. Barrington was that this man's admittance to the newly created asylum in Morganton coincided with the time of my brother's disappearance. So naturally, desiring to follow all possible leads, I had journeyed to the institution to ascertain for myself if this poor fellow might indeed be my missing brother. The story was far-fetched at best and raised more than a few eyebrows. But despite their initial reluctance, the doctors had no option once I asserted my unwavering intention to see Pritchard, but to sheepishly honor my request and allow me to visit him. Since he had generated so many outlandish stories and provided such vivid descriptions of demonic hallucinations while incarcerated in the hospital that confirmed the diagnosis of madness, his failure to recognize me did little to arouse suspicion. In truth, part of my story was accurate. I had learned of Pritchard's admission to the asylum from the hotel owner in Gray Eagle, and I had been living in England for the last 2 years as a result of a rather unpleasant disagreement with my business partner. My real reason for returning to North Carolina, I still do not understand myself. I grow weary of this writing. No more today. September 18. After reviewing my previous entry, I realize I should get to the point and address the issue. Over this 2-year period, I had been experiencing a most disturbing series of dreams, or I should say a repetition of the same dream with some variations. The original dream was quite simple. Not unlike the narrator of Dante's Inferno in the first canto, I find myself walking in a dark, unfamiliar wood, and am aware of an inexplicable sense of harrowing fear. I suddenly come into a clearing in which there sits a large mansion, dark and foreboding. I cannot say why, but an unmistakable awareness of evil permeates the dream. The house appears inhabited, for it shows no signs of decay or disrepair, yet there are no signs of life about it, no people, horses, servants, nothing. The 2 darkened windows on the second floor above the massive door set off by the white walls of the house peer down at me like the eyeless sockets of a skull. I feel, although I cannot explain how, that the house has been waiting for me. An uncontrollable sensation of being pulled into the house overcomes me, and I find myself moving toward it, although I'm not aware of any conscious effort on my part to walk in that direction. In fact, it seems that my feet are not moving at all. It's difficult to determine whether I am moving toward the mansion or if, in defiance of all logic, it's gliding toward me. Just as I arrive within an arm's length of the entrance, the door slowly opens, all light vanishes, and I awaken. My heart races just to recall this much of the dream, and yet what follows is so much worse. Enough. I can write no more. September 22. I am extremely upset. I have been so sedated I do not even remember taking meals for the last 3 days. I wish only to sleep, but yet I fear to close my eyes knowing the dream will return. The sedative allowed me a period of blessed, dreamless relief in the form of an extremely deep sleep. Apparently, the dosage has been lessened, for even though I am groggy, I find myself in this gray world again. The doctor says writing will ease my suffering, so again, I put pen to paper. This dream has plagued me every night for the last 2 years. Gradually, it began to dominate even my waking hours, for whenever I was left with no pressing matters at hand, I found myself thinking of the mansion. I racked my brain for a clue from childhood and adolescence as to where I might have seen it, for I knew with certainty that the house existed. It had to exist. I don't know how I knew this, but there was no doubt in my mind that it was real. Still, I could not recollect the faintest hint of any time when I had visited such a place. As the weeks and months passed, my obsession with the house grew so that I could think of nothing else. I became morose and irritable. The women with whom I dallied increasingly irritated me with their silly, childish prattle, and I frequently argued with the boorish acquaintances with whom I often imbibed at the gentlemen's clubs. I thought only of the mansion, and increasingly began to feel so drawn to it that I was quite maddened with the idea of finding it. Being able to withstand the yearning no longer, I eventually booked passage back to the States, and upon arriving there, traveled by rail to the western region of North Carolina. This was an odd course of action, as I have no relatives or friends there, with my equally inexplicable destination being the small mountain community of Gray Eagle. Upon disembarking from the train, I reserved a suite at the pretentious hotel whose proprietor, the aforementioned Mont Stepp, had audaciously deemed as luxurious. But as it was situated near the depot, it sufficed. Shortly after becoming settled in my quarters, I learned from the loquacious hotelier that Gray Eagle had become a popular site that attracted naturalists, scientists, and excursionists who wished to explore the wide variety of flora and fauna in the region. The recent declaration that nearby Mount Mitchell was the highest peak east of the Mississippi, along with the recent completion of the railway system, had helped to establish Gray Eagle as a destination for adventurists. Stepp told me, too, that this region has attracted the attention of spiritualists and adherents from a wide array of religions. National organizations of Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians, he said, have discussed plans for building religious retreats in the area in the near future. According to Stepp, Cherokee natives who had lived there for hundreds of years also regarded it as being an extraordinarily spiritual place. All of this information was delivered in a most annoying fashion, as I had no desire to engage in frivolous conversations with either the idiotic tourists or the equally aggravating locals like Stepp. I did discover, to my own surprise, a compulsion to purchase a horse and the supplies needed for an excursion of several days into the surrounding territory. From whence this desire originated, I haven't the vaguest idea. It simply surfaced once I had heard Stepp's account. Since adventures of this nature were commonplace in Gray Eagle, it was a simple matter to find a supplier for these necessities within a short walk from the hotel. While purchasing the equipment I desired, I inquired of the fatuous storekeeper, as casually as possible, if he were aware of any grand old mansions, perhaps abandoned or at least vacated for the present, in some remote wooded area in the region. His speech was as much an assault to the ear as was his appearance to the eye.
"Well, now, let me see," he replied. "There's a Simmons place on the edge of town, but I can't see why anybody'd be interested in it. Damn thing should have been tore down years ago. Eyesore's what it is, yes, sir. Now, if you go south about 10 or 12 miles, there's four or five old places, beauties in their day. Years ago, some rich folks from up north tried to start their own settlement out there. None of them knowed anything about working the land, although you couldn't have told them that, no sir. But finally they got disgusted and up and left.
Too bad nobody ever tried to fix them places up. Beautiful things they were in their day. As the fellow rambled on, my patience began to wear thin until he finally said something that made me start.
Now, there is a Baden Hall east of here, but I wouldn't go up there if I was you. 20 miles or so of the damnedest land you'd ever want to travel. Hell, you'd probably get lost trying to get there. God knows plenty of people have, and never come back, neither.
With this last phrase, the storekeeper lowered his voice and winked surreptitiously, as if talking of something forbidden that should not be overheard, but which he was privileged to know and even more generous to share with me. "Who is the proprietor of this enigmatic estate?" I asked.
"How's that?" he said, his vapid face clearly puzzled. "I didn't exactly follow you."
"Who owns the property?" I repeated, enunciating each word slowly while trying unsuccessfully to keep the frustration out of my voice.
"Well, nobody now. Fact is, I never did hear of anybody actually living there any time. The house has just always been there, according to what people say. Story has it that some foreigner built it before Grey Eagle was even settled. I reckon his name was Abaddon, because that's what's chiseled in the stone out front of the place."
As he mentioned this last bit of information, my mind immediately conjured the image of the words Abaddon Hall, carved elegantly into the stone directly over the door, not, however, out front, as the storekeeper had said. The mental process of picturing this image was, strangely enough, not that of remembering, for that inscription had never appeared in my dream. The feeling was akin to the phenomenon of déjà vu. At any rate, I knew that this was the place for which I had been searching, and this new knowledge accelerated my sensation of being pulled to the house.
"Anyways," the storekeeper continued, "you'd do much better to head south. I think all I just told you is nothing but an old wives' tale. I mean, how could there have even been a house built up there in those days, since there weren't nothing but Injuns living there then? Besides, them other houses are a lot easier to find, and a lot safer, too, if you follow my drift."
He grinned moronically, displaying his yellowed, broken teeth. I barely refrained from splitting his head with my newly purchased hatchet. By noon, I had gathered my provisions, mounted the horse for which I had grossly overpaid, and headed due east of the town, knowing instinctively that I would be led to the right place. After about 3 hours, I noticed a trail that headed north from the one on which I traveled, and without pausing to deliberate what to do, simply pulled the reins and guided my beast to the new path. I traveled as if in a trance, at a quick and even pace, when not impeded by the numerous thickets of undergrowth through the unfamiliar territory. Several hours, I knew not how many, had passed when I realized with a start that daylight would soon be gone, most likely leaving me still a good distance from my destination. As the darkness began to gather around me, my nerves began to become even more unsettled, so that I was unsure of my path. I decided to stop at the first clearing I came to and prepare to spend the night. Thoughts of that night caused the fear to rise within me. Demons assail my mind. I cannot write. Perhaps tomorrow. That concludes this episode of Dark Corners with David Allan Voiles. Music was provided by Mombi Uelman. To find other works by David Allan Voiles and keep up with all his projects, please visit his official author website, davidallanvoiles.com. Hope to meet you again soon in The Dark Corners.